good. Hi, everyone. I guess the mic's on. Welcome. Good job hushing. That's like your most important job. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. I'm Andy McDaniel from WAMU. Okay, one of the people who woohooed was my boss. There are a couple staff members from WAMU, but I'll take it. So at WAMU, we are delighted to be co-hosting tonight's event alongside NPR. It's going to be a really special treat. Unfortunately, I do have to start with the unenviable task of giving you some bad news. Don't worry, there's some good news, too, and some T-shirts. But the bad news is that, unfortunately, Joshua Johnson will be unable to join us this evening. The good news, and I haven't even gotten to the T-shirts, the good news is that I'm not the backup. Audie Cornish is the backup. So trust me, you will have a delightful evening, and this is going to be a very robust conversation. So just a few quick remarks before I hand off to Alicia Zuckerman. It is a really powerful thing to have all of these editorial decision makers together here in one room. And in thinking about that, you know, each day, each one of you and I make decisions that affect which stories get told and how those stories get framed. And that means what the headline is and what the lead is and what gets left out and who gets quoted. And because we're public media, I know we're passionate about this, we share a commitment to telling those stories in as nuanced and as thoughtful a way as possible. But how well we do that depends on who sits alongside us at the editorial table. At WAMU and on 1A, we are working very hard to increase the range of voices around that table and on our air, and I know many of you are as well. So it is for those reasons that we're so delighted to be here tonight. That commitment is really the only way that we can fulfill our purpose as public media, which is to help Americans understand what is actually going on in this country. So we're thrilled to be part of tonight's panel, in which you will hear from a group of incredibly powerful women of color whose job covering the White House over the last few years has required a level of courage and of grit that I personally deeply admire. They have a lot to say, they're gonna have a good time, and I can't wait to listen. So without further ado, I'm going to join you in welcoming Prindy Board President Alicia Zuckerman. Oh, and I forgot the t-shirts. John Peck, who does station relations for WAMU and 1A, really wants you to know that the 1A t-shirts in the lobby are free. We have multiple sizes, and he doesn't want to take them back to the station tonight. So with that, I pass it off. Thanks.
Thanks, Andy. Thank you, Andy. I am so glad that we could all gather here tonight at NPR for what I know will be an important and illuminating conversation on race and reporting in the current political climate. As you just heard, Joshua Johnson had to cancel. I'm sure none of you can relate to having to come up with another plan at the last minute, right? Like that doesn't happen in our business. Well, tonight's other plan is a pretty great one, as you heard. NPR's All Things Consider host Audie Cornish is stepping in to lead this discussion, coming pretty much right off after her ATC shift. She previously reported for NPR from Capitol Hill covering issues of power in Congress. She was once a reporter for the AP in Boston and came to NPR from WBUR in Boston. Tonight, she'll be talking with three people who do the work of covering the White House in a pretty challenging time to do that. I'm very glad we can sit in on this conversation about race and reporting with NPR's Audie Cornish, NPR's Aisha Rasko, the AP's Darlene Superville, and April Ryan, White House correspondent for American Urban Networks and political analyst for CNN. Thank you so much to this wonderful panel, to NPR, and to WAMU for being part of Prindy 2019 here in Washington, and Audie Cornish, thank you for making a quick pivot and joining us here tonight.
Hey. Hello, everybody. All right, you have to be nice to the sub, okay? I have been a substitute teacher, so I know how it can go horribly wrong. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for, you know, hanging out in headquarters a little bit longer. Thank you, President Zuckerman, for those remarks. And, you know, 1A is a show, of course, that's, like, known for, you know, being a reflection for the nation so that we can really be unflinching in our look at ourselves. And so tonight, basically, we hope that we're going to continue in that spirit. The conversation will be candid. And we're going to talk about race. We're going to talk about gender. We're going to talk about reporting. We're going to talk about this White House. And, you know, we're going to be really tackling what it's like to have a very specific experience in that White House press corps, including the challenges, the highlights. You guys are really going to get it, so I'm glad that you're here. So, joining us on stage first for NPR Studio One is April Ryan. White House correspondent and American Urban Radio Network's political analyst for CNN. She also informed me that, like Aretha Franklin, she does not leave her purse behind. And I get it. I get it. Nothing wrong with that. But it may mean she doesn't trust you, so you'll just have to accept that. Next is our own Aisha Roscoe. Of course, White House reporter for NPR. And finally, Darlene Superville, White House correspondent for the Associated Press.
Before we get started, the reason why I carry a purse everywhere I go is if I have to run, I got it all with me. So if you know the environment that I'm dealing with, you keep it all together. So if there's an emergency, you know, I'm gone.
All right, I like it. And she is seated closest to the exit, and I respect it. All right, so before we get started, I just want to mention the fact that, you know, just this year, the museum honored Alice Dunnigan. She was the first Black woman to gain credentials for the Capitol Press Galleries and to be credentialed for the State Department and the White House. She was born in Kentucky in the early 1900s, and she worked at local papers and was a freelancer until she basically convinced the Associated Negro Press to have her as the Washington bureau chief, which she achieved that in 1947. And the first thing she did was apply for a press credential, which needless to say, they did not give her right away. Mm. She wasn't even really paid well or on time. She had to pawn her watch every Saturday night so that she would have enough money to eat until her paycheck came on Mondays, and she'd go back and get the watch. She stoked the furnace in her apartment building to help pay rent. By 1948, she was one of two women to have White House press pool credentials covering Harry Truman. She had to raise the money herself because her boss said, quote, women don't go on trips like this. And she so frustrated President Eisenhower that he stopped calling on her for 2 years.
That sounds familiar.
Dunnigan officially retired in 69. She died in 83. The museum had her sculpture on display for a few months. I think it's now back in Kentucky. But the point is, it's hard not to look at you all and think of her. So thank you for coming tonight.
And welcome.
So, so one of the things I think people want to know is first just how you get started. Because I know that we've all had that moment where you walk into that first press conference and you realize you might be the only woman of color, you might be the only woman, depending on what year you started. That happened to me, and it was 2008, post-Obama. That's not what I expected. So maybe I can start with you, Darlene, like how you got started in the business.
I went to college. I majored in journalism. I'm from New York. I went to New York University, majored in journalism, ended up landing an internship at the Associated Press, and started working in New Jersey. New Jersey led to Washington, covered a number of different beats in Washington, general assignment. I did some politics. I did housing and urban affairs, covered HUD and organizations like the NAACP for a short period of time. Then I segued into some editing. I was on the politics desk for four different presidential campaigns. And after one of those presidential campaigns, I said to myself, and actually it was after Obama's campaign, after he won. And there was a lot of talk at the time about how lacking in diversity the White House press corps was, and it really was, with the exception of April and a few others. And asked my bureau chief at the time if I could go to the White House, because after every presidential election, the reporters who are covering the campaign, they need new assignments because the campaign is over. And so people can move
around. And it's very
much
a stepping stone kind of assignment.
Yes, and the campaign coverage is a stepping stone assignment. People get moved around. I asked to go to the White House. My bureau chief at the time said yes. And so I covered the inauguration on January 20th and January 21st. I was in the White House briefing room with the rest of my colleagues learning how to cover the White House.
All right, Aisha, I want to start with you because you're in radio now. You just made the transition.
Yes.
But tell us a little bit how you got started in the business.
So I always wanted to be a journalist, right? And since I was like in middle school, I took an aptitude test. They said, oh, you would be a good journalist. And I was like, well, that makes sense.
You believe that test?
I believe the test.
Like when I saw that, I was like, you'll be an engineer. And I was like, don't know about that.
Well, you know, I thought that journalists, I was like, that sounds really cool. And you're probably dressed really cool. And I didn't really have a lot of of what a journalist was. But I was like, that sounds cool. And so I went after it. I went to Howard University, was a print journalism major there. And then I ended up at Reuters and covering, for years, I covered like energy policy, some things really obscure, energy futures markets and things like that.
Smart stuff.
LNG exports and all of that stuff. And at times I remember being, one of the only black people around. And I would think like if anyone wants to describe me, they could just say, who you're looking for, you can go to that black girl over there. And that would be enough, because I was the only one. And at conferences and things like that, it could be hundreds of people, and I would be the only one. And so then ended up, through time, I ended up covering energy and legal issues, and then I ended up at the White House. But, I mean, I will say I was surprised when I came to the White House. There's still a long, long way to go. But I saw Darlene at the White House. I saw April at the White House. There were other black reporters there. And so I'm always careful, like, when my family members will be like, oh, you're the only one. I'm like, no, I'm not the only one.
That's right.
There are other people there. There are other black people there. Now, there should be more. Mm-hmm. But there are black people at the White House. So it was a blessing for me to be able to see my peers like April and like Darlene doing the work.
All right, April, how about you?
Okay.
What did your high school aptitude test say you were going to be?
Did you tell you to be a journalist?
No, you know what? I didn't even go. I was just like, I remember in high school, what am I going to do? And I wanted to get into computers, and the nun in the computer class said, you don't have a logical mind. I was like, oh, God. So I said, computers.
That a nun said this.
The nun. I was in Catholic high school. In Baltimore. I was like, oh, my God, my future is gone. And then I said, okay, wait a minute. What do I like to do? So I said, I like to do things in the home. I said, interior decorating. I said, no. I mean, I'm serious. This is in high school. So then I said, but I like to talk. And I went to the local radio station, WEAA. And I'm in Baltimore. Yes, yes. Public radio. We love public radio.
On brand.
I have that public radio voice right now. So anyway. So I'm thinking about that Saturday Night Live clip. Yeah. Anyway, Diane Rehm. Remember that? I said, I want to be in radio. And I loved radio. There was a guy that attended my church. He was doing the gospel program on Sunday. I went to the station. I was like, oh, my God. I fell in love. But I didn't realize. And I became a DJ. You know, when I attended Morgan State, I was DJing between classes on Fridays and Sundays overnight. And I said, something's missing. I said, you can tell the temp and the time and the station ID, but I said, there's something missing. And I wanted to get involved in news. I started producing a news program. And I said, this is it. And then, I mean, I was a DJ for a while. I was at WEBB. James Brown used to own it, but not when I was there, you know, James, the James Brown. I did a couple things, but I ultimately settled in news in Baltimore, traveled to Chattanooga, worked in Frederick, did a little WTOP, but I love it. And it goes back to growing up. My parents were very information-based. We were a very information-based family. We would listen to the radio AM in the morning, watch the news. We've always watched Walter Cronkite. That's the way it was, you know? So I went back home, you know? I didn't find myself until I found myself producing that show. And so I wound up at the White House working for American Urban Radio Networks because wherever I traveled to, I would always do some freelance pieces, and they really liked me. And I broke some news. The big story that I broke was the story about Ben Chavis when he left the NAACP. Remember that? Mm-hmm. That was like, oh my God, the world was coming to an end. How the president of the NAACP is going to leave. And I broke the story that it's not about if, but how and when he will leave. And they decided to hire me, and it took a year, but I've been at the White House since 1997. And when I came, there were a lot of African Americans because Bill Clinton was the president. It was the second term. He was considered at that time, quote, the first black president. So.
Narrator, he was not the first black president. Wait, so let me jump in here very briefly. Because I think what happens in order to, I feel like women journalists are a little bit of a special breed, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think as women, we're taught to be like polite and maybe kind of wait to be spoken to a little bit and like don't make too much of a fuss. And that's literally the definition of being a journalist, right? Like you're not always polite, you're definitely making a fuss. And that's why journalists in movies are lame, because they always make the woman sleep with the source. Because they're like, what's a woman doing here talking? Let's give her something.
You watch too much
do.
House of Cards.
Yeah, exactly. No, you watch, you'll see. No journalist is in a movie, a woman, without sleeping with her source. But of course, that's not what we do. We're out there hustling every day. So tell me what your typical day is like. Aisha, let me start with you.
You know, my day starts out with, I always have my phone right by the bed, which I know they don't recommend, but I have I have alerts, and so my day starts off with what was the tweet of the morning, because that can set the tone for the day. If the tweet is really, really out there, I can say, okay, this is going to be a long day. We got a lot of stuff we're going to have to get into, but usually it's like that, and that's on those days. I have those days where I'm doing up first. I'm up at 4 in the morning. I had been preparing the night before. I'm on the radio at 5. I may be on again at 6. I'm trying to get sleep in between there because, you know, I got the 3 kids and stuff, so I'm trying to sleep whenever I can. And then, you know, going throughout the day. Sometimes I'm at the White House, and on those days it's more around what the president is doing. And so if he has big events or if Sarah Sanders is leaving, then I'm jumping on All Things Considered to do that. Or we used to have briefings. We don't have those anymore.
But what's that?
You know, we used to have those a long time ago. We used to have these briefings. And so that used to be a part of the day. And then you're just pursuing stories, like long-term stories, getting, you know, reporting that. And then whatever is kind of just breaking, running upstairs. We all do that. To upper press and trying to figure out what's going on, what's happening, you know, what's going to happen next. So that's kind of like the typical day.
And Darlene, for you, typical day? I know I started out at the Associated Press and I was always terrified because it was like the news. Mm-hmm. You know, people would come up to you after and be like, what was that quote? And I'm like, why are you asking me?
You're
the Associated Press. Yeah, so what's your typical day like?
Well, I would start out by saying that I really don't have a typical day. There is just so much that's going on at the White House every single day that no 2 days are alike. And take the example of yesterday. I came in. I traveled with the president on Tuesday. He was in Iowa all day, and that was the day that ABC News traveled with him, George Stephanopoulos, and he did this, got all this great access that we never get.
No, yeah. I was on the trip too.
She was on the trip. See? Yeah. Everything
yes,
just.
Yeah.
You two were together and you didn't know you each
we
other
knew
were
we
there?
We were together, but it's been a long week.
Since Tuesday.
Very long week.
So, He traveled on Tuesday, did the interview with George Stephanopoulos, and then yesterday, ABC has been slowly dribbling out little blurbs of what the president had said. And yesterday was the day when he unveiled his concept for the new paint job for Air Force One. So when I got to work yesterday, my assignment was to try to write a story about Air Force One. Lo and behold, a couple hours after that, I was writing about Kellyanne Conway and the Office of Special Counsel recommending that she be fired for violating the Hatch Act. If any of you know what the Hatch Act is, you can't do partisan politics when you're a federal employee, and certainly not at the White House. And then a couple hours later, I was writing about Sarah Sanders' surprise announcement that she was leaving the White House. So you can come into work with sort of an idea of how you think your day is going to go, and then the president has other ideas, and your day goes in a different, much different direction.
Now, April, I see you on TV, and then, like, we hear you, and you're tweeting like crazy. So I was going to ask when Aisha sleeps, but now I've just learned, and I'm a little bit worried. But for you, seriously, like, what is your typical day like?
All right, so let's set the stage. When you say your day never stops. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 24 hours. And it's unfortunate. I don't sleep, and that's sad. I know. I have bought a weighted blanket to put me to sleep. I mean, it's that bad.
Yeah, that's what babies do. They have weighted blankets for
babies. I need
babies.
To be swaddled. So, so here's the deal. So if you really look at it, I mean, news happens all the time. We cover everything presidential, anything and everything presidential. And this president doesn't sleep either. He will tweet in the middle of the night. Some of our colleagues, while he was in London, he was tweeting at 1:30 in the morning. We were like, ooh, that's a problem. But it's our job. So I'll wake up. Let's say I'm in bed. I'll wake up maybe 1 or 2 in the morning, and I'll pick up my phone, which you are not supposed to do. And I'll look. You're not supposed to do it. And I'll look to see who has texted or who has reached out. Because you could actually miss a source. So I'll look, and then I'll go back to sleep. I'll text them, and I'll go back to sleep and wake up about 2 or 3 hours later. And I'll turn CNN on. I'll look through my phone, look at the news, get dressed, make breakfast for the children. I try to go to work out for health to give back to myself. I drop the kids off at 8 or 7:30 and go to the trainer. Get in the car, take the 2-hour drive to work, talk to sources, 2 hours each way. Yes, I live in Baltimore. Did you hear the groans across the room? So, but you know what? That 2 hours is a way for me to decompress. This is a hard job. You are hurry up, and there's a hurry up and wait, and you have to talk to sources. You have to. It's like constantly trying to get a master's degree or a doctorate degree and never receiving it. You have to research and study. So those 2 hours as I'm decompressing each way, I'm talking to sources, listening to the news. And I mean, I'm telling you, it is the best thing for me to be able to talk to sources. So I'm always sourcing. The news happens, you do the news, you do how many ever stories, you run to CNN, you come back, you do the stories, you listen to your daughter, hey, I need you to set up a play date, okay, let's do that, and then you get back on the story. It's not easy, but our job is to inform the masses. You can never overstudy on a story because it's important for people to get, especially now, for people to get the information, all sides of the story.
Now, yeah, go ahead. One thing I want to talk about is the idea of representation in that room and how we talk about issues of race. When I brought up Alice Dunnigan, remember she was working for like the Negro Press, but we've now reached a point, obviously past integration, where we're working for major mainstream news outlets, not necessarily on the quote unquote race beat. How do you think though about issues of race and how you try and distinguish yourself or approach it on this particular job? Darlene, for you?
That's a good question.
Because it used to be I kind of felt like if you pitch too many race stories, your news director would be like, oh, that's what you do, and you would never get a good assignment again because you were now going to be, air quotes, pigeonholed.
Right, you'd become the race reporter.
Yeah, and it was actually, you know, very conflicting mm-hmm. as a person coming up, like mm-hmm. owning the things I was interested in, feeling responsible, but also wanting to feel like I had full access to a career path.
Yes. And one of the things at AP that helps is that we have a designated race and ethnicity team, so they will often do a lot of those stories, even if they happen to cross over into the White House territory, because, again, there is just so much going on every single day that my colleagues and I, and there are four other reporters that are physically in the White House briefing room in the AP booth. We have a sixth colleague who's based up in New York, and we can't do it all. So a lot of different reporting gets farmed out to other B reporters. So that's how, you know, if I can't physically do the story myself, then we'll delegate it to the race and ethnicity team.
But do you want to? Are there questions you raise sometimes that you think other reporters might not?
Yeah, sometimes there are, just because of who I am. Yeah, that comes into play because you cannot separate the fact that I am a Black woman covering this administration that does not have the best reputation when it comes to those issues.
Aisha, how do you think about this? I know that as coming up, I definitely would get an assignment that was along the lines of, we need Black voters, maybe a barbershop? and I would look at that email and shake my damn head like, I can't believe this is happening. But I don't want to put that experience on you. How do you think about covering race while you're covering the White House?
It is like, it's something that obviously I am who I am and I bring that wherever I go. But it's something that I definitely think about. Like, you know, there are times when I wonder, you know, should I ask this question because you're one of the few Black people in the room? And it's like, do I just want to ask about the Black issues? Do I just want to ask about Black unemployment? Even though that is something that I think is important and that this administration talks about all the time. So I'll go back and should I? But then I'll say, well, if I don't ask it, well, it might not get asked. And this is important and this matters. And so I try to, and I am interested in, you know, what is happening to Black Americans and to Black people. That's not the only thing I'm interested in. I'm interested in a lot of things, but I can't say that is not something that I think I'm concerned about what's happening that's affecting my family, that's affecting my loved ones, that's affecting people that I know and grew up with. And so if these issues are important and they're not necessarily being covered, I don't have a problem being the person who's saying, look, I want to talk about that. I did a story last year about the way President Trump tweets about Black people, because at that time he was talking about LeBron James was stupid and Don Lemon was stupid and all of these things. And I wanted to talk about that and to look at how and compare to the way he talks about other people. And that was, I felt like, an important story. I am a Black reporter, but I bring expertise and knowledge and all of that. But I think it's important to also hear my voice. I've gotten, you know, certain letters or things from people, correspondents, and they say, I heard your voice on the radio and I thought you were talking about race in America. And I was shocked when I heard you talking about other things. And I'm glad that you can talk about other topics than just race. So I think it's
like, thank you.
I get a lot of
really crummy fan letter.
I get very weird, like,
oh, girl, I know. We could talk after.
But that to me drives home that it is important that my voice is out here because people know that I'm a Black woman. When they hear me, they know it. And it's important that they hear me talking about a variety of issues and also talking about those issues that may not get talked about enough.
Yeah, I should note there was a newsletter of some kind where the columnist talks about like language
yes.
and phonetics. And he did a column about me and Aisha yes. talking to each other. And it was like, the Black woman, how she says blah, blah, blah. And I was looking at it
like,
is this from 1919? Like, what am I, how did you get the internet? Like, it was very strange. All right, so April, you and I had talked about this a little bit because you are fearless on a variety of topics. But on this in particular, I think you suffer for being fearless, right, in terms of your criticism from the public and from the president. So how do you think about this?
So let me say this. We ask questions. We happen to be Black women who are journalists, who can ask questions about everything. Let's put that on the table.
Absolutely.
And we do. When I was told, stop shaking my head, I was asking about Russia. Mm-hmm. For real. Mm. When I was in the Oval Office the other day when we had like a crazy pool day, Darlene mm-hmm. was there. I asked about, Mr. President, are you going to meet with Putin? He said, yes. Do you want to come in the room? I said, yes, as a reporter to cover it. And that he wanted to open it up to reporters. That's what questions will do. But I'm not going to apologize for being in this unique perch and asking questions for a community that still has the highest numbers of negatives in almost every category. I'm not going to apologize. Everything comes to the White House, from war to peace and everything in between. The late Helen Thomas, the former dean of the White House Press Corps, said that. Go run, tell that. So she told that to me. But when it comes, and I want to put this in perspective, because this is serious. And people, you know, they like to say I'm a race baiter. They want to kill me because I ask questions about race. Take my life because I ask questions about race in this moment in time. Okay? This is serious. So I'm going to take you back in time. Then President LBJ commissioned a panel to look at why there was rioting in cities like LA, Newark. And he commissioned this panel that was called the Kerner Commission, an 11-member panel. If you don't know about it, Google it. And that panel was commissioned to find out, you know, again, why there were these riots. And it all stemmed from police-involved abuses in the communities. Cyclical, right? But in the commission's report, it said we're still a community separate and yet unequal. But there were suggestions towards the end. And this is what people don't talk about. And it's right in the report. The report talks about one of the ways to change the dynamic to stop this kind of unrest and dis-ease in communities is to have Black reporters in these high spaces and places and government places to ask questions about the Black community to the leaders of either City Hall, the State House, or the White House. So for those who say, how dare I, go read your history book.
You know, I think another aspect of this that we don't talk about very often is that the reason why these women and others are in this position of even having to answer a question like this is because your white colleagues are not doing it and don't
they
see
won't.
Any reason
until a crescendo
to, or
moment.
Not. Right, until there's a problem, right, until it's really a crisis moment. So there, often it's just like not in the view. Right? And as much as people are like woke or whatever, it's not getting all the way. So I think that
they
it's really important to talk about this. It's really important to talk about this. All right. So I want to ask you about how you feel like, and this question I do want to ask, how you guys feel like you have been treated, because I think because this president, we're not going to start with April, let's just say that specifically, this president has been criticized about how he speaks about and to people of color. And I just told you here, Dunnigan, like Eisenhower was like, yo, dead silence to you for the next 2 years, all right? So we're not the first to deal with these issues. But do you feel like you hear, in a way, coded insults, or do you feel like you are insulted or criticized in an undue manner from this White House in general?
Look, they have to think about it. Look at it. I can tell you straight out, but go ahead, let them.
I wouldn't say that I feel like I have been specifically singled out. Now, I will say, and when we did have the briefings on numerous occasions, I would ask a question and I would be told, basically you don't understand civics. If you understood civics, I was heard told this by, I think, Milk Mulvaney and Sarah Sanders. I can't say that that's specific, but I had that is my experience. That's
you attended
I
Howard University.
I
you
had civics.
And you had a civics course, didn't you?
I understand. No, I understand civics. I've covered politics and policy for a very long time, but I think there definitely was a time, and I'm sure April will talk about this, when President Trump had attacked Yamiche Alcindor and called her racist.
She's from PBS.
From PBS,
right?
And called Abby Phillips from CNN and said she was stupid or asking dumb questions, asked stupid questions, and then attacked April Ryan. And obviously, there are only so many black women in the press corps. And so at that point,
he told Kristen to be quiet in the Oval Office yesterday.
Just the other day. So there are only so many of us. So sometimes it is, you know, it is a question of like, are they going? Is it going down the line?
Right.
Like, there are only
and you're
so
not behaving like a
us.
Jim Acosta, right?
No.
Who's literally out there wielding a sword, practically.
No.
To do battle with the White House in one way or another.
No. And so for these journalists to be kind of singled out, you do have to take notice of that. Mm-hmm. And I remember we went on the Paris trip right after that, and I remember like seeing all of this stuff and going, "What, you know, this is a lot to take in." Like I said, there are only so many of us, and yet we all of these women seem to be getting attacked.
Reporting while black.
So there's, I mean, so that is, I think that is something that you do carry to a certain extent.
Does it affect your ability to do the journalism?
No.
No. Go ahead.
Well, I always say that, you know, you don't get into journalism to be liked by the people that you cover. And
but this is a new level, Darlene. This is a new level.
Yes, it is a new level, and I have not experienced the level of invective that has been.
Use your word, invective. Yes. We're friends.
If anyone wants to give us a podcast after the program, we are happy to oblige.
You should have heard us backstage. Yeah.
That's the not safe for work version, but yes.
I have not experienced the level of disdain this White House has shown to you personally. But I would say that it's just been overall very distressing to just see and watch and hear the way the president and other people in this administration just denigrate the media and single out individual reporters and attack them, and in some cases put their lives at risk. So, you know, we get into this to do the job, which is journalism, you know, find the truth, ask the questions, get to the bottom of whatever the story of the day is, and I always try to keep that in the front of my mind as I do my work every day. And I think most of my colleagues do that too. You just have to keep pushing forward and leave the noise behind you and just try to do your best job every day, which is what I think we all try to do every day.
April, do you think that there is something positive in the fact that people identify this as what it is in a way, right? Like the criticism of the president in doing this has been written about, and it's not a situation maybe like it would have been in the past where you're sitting there in the room like, is it me or is such and such a thing happening? It feels like it's something that is being called out in real time.
Well, let me say this. There was a time during the campaign, there was a lot of code used and people were like, oh, well, he doesn't mean it. You know, he's not gonna be like that when he's president. I'm like, if he's saying it now, trust me. And people were not, they were excusing it then. And to a certain extent, they're excusing it now. They're calling it out, but it's still accepted. The late John McCain called it out. It's still accepted. This is not Russia, this is not China. A free press is part of the pillars of this democracy. We're the part of the undergirding, the foundation that the founding fathers put in place. They never expected Darlene Superville, Aisha Roscoe, or an April Ryan, let alone a Barack Obama or Donald Trump. But they put in place this piece when checks and balances would fail, that you had people asking questions for accountability. Now the tables have turned to smear us when we are asking legitimate questions that you don't want to answer. It's not us. And there's still a segment of society who doesn't understand. They're the ones who didn't take civics or government class. They don't understand that this is part, and they talk about, oh, the Constitution. Well, do you know what the Constitution says? They don't know, and then they want to hurl insults at you for questions. I have every right to question Sarah Huckabee Sanders. I have every right to question the President of the United States. But yet I'm wrong. Because they don't know what they don't know. And the unfortunate piece is, because I asked those questions, and for some reason, even before he became president, while he was running, they targeted me. They wanted to use me as an example. They thought that, oh, she's by herself. She's working for the small radio network. She might be doing TV, but she's at the small radio network. Nobody, but we're going to use her as an example. The worst thing they could have done. I'm from Baltimore. I'm an HBCU student, Morgan State University. I shall not, nor will not be moved. I've done nothing wrong.
Now, I want to make sure you guys have an opportunity for questions. You can see that we have a mic here. If you want to come up and question our panelists, now is the time. Don't be shy.
Because we not shy.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
So I worked in Washington for a very long time.
I worked in Washington for a very long time. I'm now in Seattle, where I get a lot of feedback that we just shouldn't even be covering President Trump. People get very angry when we even put him on the air. Mm. And so I'm sort of curious your feelings about both objectivity and how things, objectivity when covering this White House and sort of the traditional journalism that we've all been trained in very different times. And also about whether you think the media is stronger because of our current conditions or if it is weakening in terms of the access and if people are sort of accepting the new norms.
Yeah, Jill Gregg-Gustin. I get all the time notes that said, why do you talk to so-and-so from the White House? I'm like, wait, what?
You gotta inform the White House. Everyone is touched by the White House. You have to inform the masses.
The same time, I have been in that interview where I'm just listening to just like talking points that are wrong. How do I jump in? It's live. I can't edit it. The listeners are hating it. I mean, it's a little bit of a battle.
You have to come back now because they will put out, it's unfortunate, the spin or lies, whatever you want to call it, they will put that out, but you've got to give the other side or give the fact because we cannot misinform the public. We have a responsibility. So if we know that something that they're saying is wrong, we have got to challenge or ask the questions, well, Congressman so-and-so said this or this and this happened at this and this date. What do you say about that? Because we have to. We have to because the story is... Their narrative is, there's a warped sense of reality.
Darlene, let me let you jump in here because there is a question about what do you do about objectivity when the person who has the highest office in the land makes misleading statements?
You do what a lot of news organizations are doing now, which is the whole fact check industry that has risen up to, in many cases, in real time, point out where the president has said something that is flat out wrong or misleading. And you also include some fact-checking elements in your stories, depending on what the subject is.
In a way, we do it more than we used to, I think.
We do it a lot more than we used to, yes.
Yeah, I mean, and in headlines, I mean, you see the difference. Whereas before, and I was at a wire service before, so you would put out the headlines, you know, this president says this. And this was the same for Bush, for Obama. You would say, the president said this. Now you would say with certain things, the president says this without evidence. This was, there was no, you never questioned that. Not that presidents didn't at times mislead in the past, but you, if the president said this company is bringing a job, this many jobs here, you would just put that out. Like that was what, but now it's a difference. Like you, and you see that in the headlines and you see that in the way, because there are times where it just, it has been a change.
All right, next question, come on up.
Hi, my name's Erica Peterson. I'm with WFPL in Louisville. I don't have a question per se, but I just wanted to say that as somebody with two young children, it's been really nice to see, especially you, Aisha, and you, Adi, be so open in social media and some of your colleagues about the challenges of having this very demanding job and parenting and some of the challenges that go into that. So I just wanted to thank you for being so open about that.
Yeah, thank you for entertaining my embarrassing tweets.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
Come on up.
You all are just rock stars in my eyes. I mean, one of my professional bucket lists is to do a two-way with you, Audie. So
good.
Maybe
this is
one
my
day.
Crowd. Yeah. See you at the bar after.
I'm with Connecticut Public Radio. I have a question. So one of the things about the White House press corps that sort of bugs me is how when when Sarah Sanders or whoever is answering questions, they often don't answer the question, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of support from other reporters. They immediately switch to the next question. And I'm wondering from you, as your experience, do you feel like that's worse for you as women of color? And the second part of that question is, what do you think your colleagues can do to be allies, but also to just be a better White House press corps, to work together to get information?
So I will say with that we get that complaint a lot, which is, why don't you guys follow up when there were briefings and things like that? I will say, even though we're all colleagues, we don't have the same aims. Like, we work for different organizations. We have different audiences and different people that we are trying to reach. I think there are times where you do get that follow-up, and where, especially when they were, like I said, when they were having the briefings, you saw more of that. And there were times when I, like, asked a question about the Central Park Five, and April Ryan backed me up on that when I was asking a question about that. And so there are times where you do have to kind of jump in, and there are times where I think that even at the press conference one of these days, I think it was Kristen Welker who stood up, and the president was like, I wasn't pointing at you. I was pointing at Jeff Mason.
That was that same day.
Jeff Mason beside him, and Jeff Mason was like, no, let her ask a question. So, I mean, there is something there, but the press corps, they have different ideas. Everyone is unique in what they're trying to do.
So let me say this really fast, a point of history. Right now, we have a press corps that we've never seen before. You've got this infiltration of bloggers, and there's nothing wrong with bloggers, and people, these citizen journalists, and people who think they're journalists, who did not study for this. We have a lot of different people coming in, and you have also these people who come in and want to target journalists, who are journalists who target other journalists and write about it. It's a whole different press corps. But I remember when I started during Bill Clinton's time, I remember Sam Donaldson, Ann Compton, Bill Plant, Peter Mayer, Helen Thomas. When there was a momentum on something, it just kept going. It kept going. It wouldn't stop, and everyone had each other's back. This is a different day. And I've seen on Twitter how everyone is saying, why don't you back each other up? Some of you remember back then when the momentum kept going and everyone would support each other. I don't understand it, but I think it's because of the infiltration of this new media. They don't understand what media or news really is. And they want to come in and make a name. They don't realize that this is about providing information and fact. So it's a different
right, and then
day.
The influence of partisan media, right?
Yeah, like, and
so
yes,
a
most
different
definitely.
Aspect of it as well. Thank you for your question.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hi, good evening.
Hi.
My name is Thalicia Edie from South Carolina Public Radio. You guys all kind of nodded in agreement when talking about how the treatment you receive while doing your job doesn't stop you from doing your job. I wanted to know, does it impact you personally when you're off the job? Do you feel anxiety, or does it kind of formulate into some sort of trauma for you? And if so, how do you deal with it?
You know, I will say that you're dealing with a lot of sometimes very negative, and not even, not that it's personal, but just dealing with negative information. You're dealing with a lot of insults and just a lot of negative stuff in this beat. And I think at times it does affect me because it's just so, and you can tell, like, if you go on vacation and you, like, stay away from Twitter for a little while and you don't, and you get back on it, you're like, oh, this is nasty stuff. Like, this is rough. And I, you know, I can't say, I think at times you are consuming a lot of, you know, going back and forth and all of that. And I can't say that that doesn't affect you personally. I think that we all kind of have to figure out how to deal with that and how to handle that and how to cope. But I think it does affect, it affects me at times.
I think I would say that it probably manifests itself in me more in terms of stress than trauma. Again, Aisha said that we're dealing with a lot on an hourly, daily, weekly basis at the White House, and it's a lot to take in, a lot to process, a lot to absorb. The one thing that I think that bothers me the most is just this, and we've talked about this already, just the sheer hatred for the media from this institution that we have to cover. And you go into the building and you sort of think, oh, you know, what are they going to say today, that kind of thing. You sort of have to walk into the building every day kind of almost armed for battle in a way, and that shouldn't be the way that you go to work. But, you know, I exercise, I like to cook, and those things help reduce stress. It's hard to unplug, I find. I'll just speak for myself here. It's hard to unplug just because of the sheer volume of everything that's happening, and you have to have some level of awareness of everything that's going on. You don't have to be down in the nitty-gritty, but if I was away this week, I would need to know that he went to Iowa. I'd need to know that Kellyanne was reprimanded. I'd need to know that Sarah quit, those kinds of things. But I think it's just more, for me, more stress than actual trauma.
April, for you, we know you're getting in the trainer in the morning and a two-hour ride each way. How else are you dealing?
I'm going to be real honest. I suffer, I believe, from post-traumatic stress disorder. And I'm serious about that. Your head's always on a swivel, not knowing if someone's coming up to you to support you or wanting to come after you. I get emails of death threats. I get letters of death threats. FBI has reached out to me. The police in my community call me. I mean, it's at the point now I don't even have to call them. I just forward them everything via email. We communicate that way. Every day is a new day. And I always say I'm thankful that I'm alive. And people think, oh, yeah, you're alive. They don't realize what you're going through. And when I go home, I make sure that my children don't feel it. I can be crying in the corner somewhere, but my children will not know because I want them to live their lives. I've got two daughters and they don't need to know. I carry that stress with me. I have security. You know, I have to pay for security. There's a lot of things I've had to do to protect myself because I ask a question. I've had to talk to people. I've done nothing wrong. I've asked a question. I've been lied on. They've tried to take my job from me. I've had death threats, but I'm still standing. But it does do. I mean, I like to laugh. I love binge watching mindless TV.
Yes.
Watching crazy movies, you know, hanging out with the kids, doing fun things, and just putting my mind, when it's time to break away, I break away. On the weekends, this weekend, I'm a veg. I might be on TV once, but I'm a veg. That's the way I deal. And it's real.
Yeah.
Thank you for your question.
It's real, but it shouldn't be that way. And that's one of the bottom lines here. Yeah.
Good evening, ladies. My name is Gabrielle Jones. I work with WCVE in Richmond, Virginia. You ladies talked about the volume, the sheer volume that comes at you, and it feels to be a little bit different from this administration in particular. You also talked about being able to shape your time to cover stories that are of special interest to you, and I'm wondering how you prioritize that with all of the, it makes me think of that, there's a kids movie where the dogs go squirrel, like I kind of feel like they're just sort of like throwing stuff out there at you. So how you prioritize what you're going to cover with all that's out there, and how you negotiate with your editor if you have a different idea of what the important news is for the day.
Ah, we won't ask who your boss is. And after, these will be the last two questions after you.
Well, a lot of the prioritizing, at least for me, it just comes from our editors. They have a news meeting in the morning. We have a president that starts tweeting at 5 a.m., 6 a.m. Often he's doing that to try to set the tone for the day. Then there are other things going on. There's lots happening on Capitol Hill these days, in addition to the White House and in the courts with the Russia investigation at one point. So a lot of the prioritizing is, it's kind of top down. You know, this is what we want. We want you to do this, that kind of thing. The process is give and take, and I can sort of come back to the editor and say, well, I think this, but oftentimes it doesn't get very far. And then in terms of the sheer volume, while you're doing the important story of the day, when you're finished with that, and if you have extra time before you can leave the office, then you chip away at something else. You take the quiet moments that you have and chip away at an enterprise piece or a feature story or something like that. So that's how it goes, at least for me.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same. I mean, it is a lot of times things are just being thrown at you, so you may have like a longer piece that you're working on and you're trying to get that done in the midst of whatever is breaking at the moment. And so sometimes it's tough to get those longer pieces done because
it'll take longer to get the longer pieces done.
Yeah, because you're so wrapped up in what's happening in that moment, but there's always breaking news and it has to be covered. So if you're kind of in the slot that day, then you just have to deal with it. It, you know, it has to be dealt with. So
ditto.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Good evening.
Hi.
My name is Anne Marie. This is touched on a little bit, but I'm really curious how all of you take care of yourselves and sort of enforce boundaries between the work that you do and the rest of your lives. And it's sort of a two-part question, but what advice do you have for editors to best support reporters who are really in very stressful beats like this?
I just hate to say this, but we are in this kind of time. It's a group that supports reporters from abuses and things of that nature.
DART?
It's not the DART Center. It's another one, but DART Center is one of them. I would recommend, if you have reporters on a beat, on a hostile beat, please give them the tools to be able to handle it emotionally. I met someone, they're trying to put me in touch with people who deal with reporters who are in combat zones. This is crazy, but this is what it is. There is a residue. There is an effect. It can change you and who you are. I'm a happy-go-lucky person, but if you come at me the wrong way, I'm like, I mean, seriously, you're always on guard. This will change you. So I pray that you guys will, if you have reporters in a hostile environment, be it city hall, state government, or even in Washington, or in the combat zone, you will give them the support that they need emotionally and the time that they need, because you don't know someone's breaking point. And we all need a job.
Yeah, please be on guard for burnout. I think sometimes there's a little bit of an editor swagger that says, this is the news, kid. So you gotta do blah, blah, blah. You're drowning and you don't feel like you can say it because you don't wanna damage your career. So I think a lot of people in this room are in a position to guard against this by taking the signs seriously. People who are a little bit more irritable, people who are a little bit more frustrated, like the story's taking a little bit longer. Sometimes people need a break, and it's okay. I'm at ATC. You can tell the network, we don't have it. We'll find a way to get it. But I've been there when you work 6, 7, 8 days in a row without any kind of break.
Or longer.
Yeah.
Blaze Ganey from Tallahassee, Florida, WFSU. How do you feel like you reply to people, or you talked about like on Twitter sometimes it's a lot going on, and you get hate mail, emails, and letters. Do you feel the need sometimes? I mean, of course you want to stand up for yourselves, but are you scared to stand up for yourselves, or do you stand up for yourselves at times?
Okay, they're looking at me because
I don't get what April gets. If I get anything like negative, I just block. I block people and I don't respond to it. And you know, as long as I thank God I haven't at this point gotten threats. So I just anything that's
and I
really
pray
crazy,
you never do.
Thank you. And I just I block with the quickness. And then if they just say something like about my voice or something like that, then I just mute them. I just mute you. I don't want to listen to it anymore.
Well, I'm not mature like Aisha, because I'm telling you. I am now known for my Twitter wars with everybody on Twitter. Daddy Huckabee came after me on Good Friday. I let him know I'm not the one. And if you saw it, it got ugly because I said that Sarah, you saw it. I said that Sarah should have been fired because she lied to the American public, and she acknowledged it under oath to Mueller and his investigation team. If you can't trust, so he goes off and talks about me, I should lose my pass and all this old stuff, and then lies on me saying I said something about his daughter on Fox News. I'm like, and you are creating the atmosphere for hate. So I'm going to say this to you. For me, I have been told by people on the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue that I have to be loud about it when they come after me. Because if I don't, if something happens, people won't know and they'll leave me alone. So when I'm on Twitter, I'm loud about it. I'm real loud about it.
Occasionally, I will try to reason with somebody that either tweets it or emails. And no, it's true. And I
have you reason with crazy. You cannot reason with crazy.
No. You can try. And one time I did.
You will lose your mind.
I did get a woman who apologized for calling me a name after we
that
had
one
a
time
bit
out of how many.
I have to say, social media is not built for this. If you think about a blocking mechanism or a mute mechanism, it basically operates on the idea that everyone gets you to slap you in the face once. Then you get to block, right? But someone has to commit the offense first. Yeah. If you have a full day of that, a full feed of that, it's a lot of hits.
Yeah.
One thing I've learned is that there's a lot of people out in the world who feel voiceless, who feel powerless, mm-hmm. and they take it out on us because they have access to us. And I've had to teach myself not to punch down, so to speak. Yeah. Daddy Huckabee's a little different, right? That's like everyone is a titan there. But there's a lot of people out there who will throw out a thing, and I realize, like, this is the highlight of their whole day.
That's right.
And this is not the highlight of my whole day.
That's right.
So sometimes, you know, I'll just let them have that moment.
Yeah.
A lot of times being polite works, oddly, because as soon as people are kind of called out on weird behavior, then it's like, oh, actually, I'm a big fan. It's like, oh.
And they're shocked that you actually
And they're
respond.
Shocked that you reply. Yes. Because remember, we're not people, we're avatars, right? We are symbols of things. You all have this as well. We are symbols of things. In public radio, we go out into spaces. I covered the South, and it was like, oh, NPR. And I always had to be prepared to counter all of the perceptions around that. So it is my piece of advice not to get into big social media battles with people because it has diminishing returns. And again, this is when you're dealing with civilians, not with people who are like trying to make a point and use you. But it's something to think about because I think a lot of young reporters coming up, when they go from having a smaller following to a larger one, they start getting into little battles and you'll be like, yo, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. That's not worth your time. Mm-hmm. You are bigger than that. Yeah. And I don't mean that in a Michelle Obama way. I mean, we are bigger than that.
Yeah.
So don't do it. I want to say a big thank you to our panelists. You guys were tremendous. April Ryan, White House correspondent for American Urban Radio Networks, Aisha Roscoe, White House reporter for NPR, and Darlene Superville, White House correspondent for the Associated Press. Thank you.
Thank you.
This was fun.
Tonight's panel discussion was produced by Haley Blassingame. We also want to thank our production team here at NPR, the 1A team, and Prindy, of course, for inviting us at this event. Please enjoy the rest of the conference. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to thank this wonderful panel for an amazingly honest and evocative conversation. I also really want to thank you all for the work that you do. We are so grateful that you do this work. We can hear how hard it is, and I just really hope that you manage to find some sleep somewhere in your schedules. And I also just want to remind people that tomorrow is the big day for the vote for our name change, and I really hope that Public Media Journalists Association is who we are at this time tomorrow, because we are not just news directors. Again, thanks to WAMU and NPR for this wonderful event, and thank you, Audie Cornish, for pivoting and for spending extra hours in your day to do this. Thank you.